Yeah, thank you. Okay, good morning. Parshas Bo is very, very exciting. I work with Parshas Bo. Parshas Bo is really the, in a way, finality of Yitzias Mitzrayim, really Parshas B'Shalach, Chazon Shiras. But the final three Makos are experienced this upcoming Shabbos. Arba Choshek and Makos Bechoros, the first mitzvah given to Klal Yisrael, is in our Parsha, the mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh, HaChodesh HaZalachem, Rosh Chodeshim, the first mitzvah the Jewish people do as a nation, which is Korban Pesach, is even a Geiros, that the Gemara explains that Jewish people went through a Geiros, a conversion process, the Bris Milah, Kabbalah's Ol Mitzvot, by accepting the mitzvahs upon themselves. Some way, somehow, they went to the mikvah. Somewhere, the Gemara talks about that. But there was a conversion process, as now, really officially, formally, they're not just B'nai Yisrael, but they're fully full-fledged Yehudim, the Jews, as well. It's a very, very harsh. Okay. So, yeah. Three more makas in the sixth parsha. Yeah. 10 is very significant. We have 10 all the time. We have the Aseret HaDibros. We have the Aseret Ma'amaros Nivru HaOlam. There are 10 utterances in which they created the world, which comes up in Daf Yomi this past Sunday. And what's the significance of all these things? There's a Zohar. There's a Zohar that writes that the 10 Ma'amaros Nivru HaOlam, the 10 utterances, Bracious, then there's a lot of Ayomers, correspond to the 10 Makos. And the 10 Makos are like a recreation of the world. And there's actually some parallels. I'm sure Rabbi Foreman, I don't know for sure, but I'm sure he has something on this, where there's parallels between some of those utterances and the Makos themselves, in that there was a macro creation of the world, that's gracious, bara. And here is a micro level of the creation of the world for Klal Yisrael, a recreation for the Jewish people themselves. The very first makkah that we meet up in this parsha is the makkah of Arba. And what's fascinating is we discussed, you know, different aspects of the ancillary parts of the makos. So here the conversations are very, very fascinating. What are they focusing on? What does Paro notice in the previous makkah? And what does that cause him to say? And so too with Moshe. And what's Moshe pushing for? What are they negotiating for in the different makos? And Mefarshim talk about how that's related to what they just experienced. So over here, the Torah says the following: Vayomer Hashem el Moshe. Hashem tells Moshe, Bo el Paro, Kani hichbadeti eslibo v'slev avadav, because I have hardened their heart and the hearts of their servants. Laman shisi ososai ela bikirbo, so they can experience these signs, the makos, in their midst. Ulaman, I want to focus on this part of the pasuk. Ulaman, tisaper bozne bincha, uven bincha, esa sher hisalalti b'mitzrayim, ves ososai asher samti bam, v'yedatem kiyanei Hashem. So, before the mak of Arba comes up, Hashem says to Moshe, there's a double reason that that we are having all these makos. One is for the Egyptians, that they experience this. And what they deserve a punishment. They need to learn something over here. And then additionally, for you. What? Laman tisaper. In order for you to tell the story, bozne bincha uven bincha, and your children, your grandchildren's ear, what I did, how I toyed with the Egyptians, v'yedatem kinei Hashem, and therefore you will know that I am God. So the Sar Shalom of Bells, and others as well, ask the following question. Uleman tisaper is talking directly, b'lashon yachid, to the individual. So you, personally, will tell your children and your grandchildren what has happened. And then the pasuk concludes, v'yedatem, and then you in plural, will know ki ani Hashem. Why is that? And secondly, why is this here by Makas Arba? Arba, if you look at like the scope and the sequence of the 10 makos, like Arba is one of those you think is just out of place. You know, it's like Barat at the end of the last week's parsha. It's like fire and ice. So it sounds like they had to conclude the season finale needed to be exciting at the end of Vayera. And then, okay, the beginning of the new season. Okay, grasshoppers. What's the big deal? Choshech, Makas, Bechoros. Okay, you understand why those are at the end. Arba, like, doesn't always fit into that mold. So why is that significant? And it seems very significant in the way that Hashem is telling Moshe right before Arba why this is like very powerful. You need to tell them about Arba. Obviously, all the other Makos as well, but this seems to be very, very significant. What is going on here? So the Belzer Rebbe, the Sar Shalom of Belz, one of the Belzer Rebbes, says the following, that the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim did not apply to the initial generation. Why didn't it apply to the first generation? They experienced it themselves. So who was the Sar Shalom of Belz talking to? He was only talking to one person here. He was only talking to Moshe. The only person that had an obligation, a chiyah, a responsibility next year to tell over the Haggadah was Moshe Rabbeinu, because it was Moshe's children that never experienced it firsthand. Uleman tisaper bozne bincha uven bincha. Moshe, you need to tell this. You're going to be the first one to tell it over to your children. And when you have grandkids, we don't know exactly when that was, but presumably that happened in Midbar, you're probably going to be the first grandfather to tell over the story to your grandchildren. So Moshe, you're going to need to model what it means for Klal Yisrael to tell over the story at Leil HaSeder. The most magical night of the year is Leil HaSeder in all the Jewish homes around the world. Grandparents and parents and children connecting generations. Really, it's such a powerful night. In fact, there is a discussion, there's an academic discussion about who wrote the Haggadah. The Haggadah is a compilation of Psukim and Midrashim and Mishnayos, but who put it together? So there is one suggestion. Maybe it's the Maharal, or maybe it's someone else. I forgot. I think it's Maharal. He suggests that it was Moshe, who was the first person to have a Seder, and that was Moshe Rabbeinu. The Jewish people had a Seder in Mitzrayim, very different type of Seder, with the Korban Pesach, and it was probably more Shiras with Tishbachos. They were probably reflective. But who was the first one to do it in this direct way? That is Moshe, telling it to a generation never experienced it before. So he argues that it was Moshe Rabbeinu that wrote the Haggadah himself, modeling for us what it means to pass on this Mesorah. And then he continues, this is Rav Druck now writing, now why is this specifically the mitzvah or the Makkah of Arba in which we highlight this aspect of the Pesach Seder, the Pesach experience? So he writes the following, really quoting a Sforno as well, that the Sforno writes that there was something unique about Arba that you needed to tell the future generations of the Jewish people, via Datem, you, he writes, and the Egyptians are going to have like a, know that Ani Hashem, Yidatem Ani Hashem, he writes, is the Jewish people and the Mitzrim. And the Egyptians are going to have this acknowledgement or this realization, this recognition of Ani Hashem at this moment. And he writes, why is that? Why is that? Because the Torah here, for the only one of the Makos, points out that this is the only time in world history that Arba is going to happen. You know, the plague of locusts will happen in Egypt's borders. Later on in history, there was a Makkah of Arba, I think in the times of Yoel or Navi, and it didn't happen to that extent in Egypt. It was blocked off. So as long as you keep this story alive, and this is part of our Mesorah, and we tell this story, then it's going to become even more impactful later on. Because you're going to understand that Haftacha that Hashem made in the Makkah of Arba, thousands of years earlier, is still Mekuyam, it's still coming true, even then. And that is very, very powerful and very, very significant. So that's what, first off, for today, about Laman Tesaper, the mitzvah, the chiyuv of the Jewish people, specifically Moshe to give it over. And Moshe really then is the model for all the Jewish people and how that we pass on the Messiah.
Rabbi?
Yes, Danny, how are you?
The other Makos didn't happen again either. It's not just Arba that didn't happen again. Boro didn't
100%. Arba is something that I would say, theoretically, could have happened. The Makkah of Dam, that is supernatural. You know, some of these might have been supernatural, maybe not Tzvardeya. This one, the Torah says, is never going to happen, even though it's likely that in this region, in the Mideast, there could be a swarm of locusts that come in and eat up all the crops. And that's why this one, it could happen. So it did happen, and they didn't enter the borders of Egypt. As if to say that, right, that there's some type of a protective fence around Egypt to protect them from the Arba. Why was the Arba so bad? Why was the Arba so bad? It was so bad because, on one hand, Bara, what did Bara do? If they're an agricultural society, what did Bara do? Bara knocked off the top layer of all of the crops, which knocks you out for like a year or two until the crops grow back. What Arba did is that the grasshoppers came in and ate underneath the ground. Whatever took root, they ate the root. So now that didn't knock them out 1 to 2 years, it knocked them out 4 to 5 years. And if you think about it, when the Egyptians needed to recover from this, this was a long recession because all the crops that took root are gone. You have to start that brand new. And all of the animals that help them plow and plant were also gone. So this was a major blow to the GDP of Egypt. Right? Egypt was a major world power then. We marginally hear about them through the rest of Tanakh as a superpower. Right? They were totally decimated as a result. Yeah.
I know the Egyptians had to suffer a lot because it was destined that when they struggled being in Egypt and they would have to be slaves.
Yeah.
But the Egyptians took it to a degree. That's, you know, how they did it. But also Hashem was part of Pharaoh's heart here. So how many times did Pharaoh
So the hardening of Pharaoh's heart is the Bar Mitzvah boy this past Shabbos discussed that, sure. He discussed Vechazek Vechabed. The last five, the language is Vechazek Esleit Paro, which is different than Vechabed Esleit Paro. He didn't make his heart stubborn, but he gave him strength for Paro to do what he really wanted to do. That's what the Sforno says. Vechazek, he strengthened Paro. He didn't have Paro fall into peer pressure to listen to everybody else, which means to give in to the Jewish people and let them go. He wanted to do what Hashem let him do what he actually wanted to do. That's what the Sforno writes over here.
Did the people want Paro to let them go already?
Yes, but he didn't want to go. He didn't. At his core, he didn't. Like if it's Motei Shabbos, your friends want to go to the movies. You want to go bowling. And they say, listen, you want to go bowling? Go bowling. Go bowling by yourself. So by you going to the movies with your friends, you're not doing what you want to do. You're doing what your friends want to do, which might be important. You want to have, you know, some socialization. Wonderful. But if you go bowling, that is mechazek eslev mendiyaron. That is showing that you are doing what you actually want to do. So that's what it's important to understand what Paro was experiencing here. Paro, Hashem gave a little chizik to Paro to follow what he wanted to do, not what the Egyptians did. Let's go back to the Makkah of Choshech. Rashi here paints a very challenging picture for the Makkah of Choshech, where Rashi writes the following question. V'lama hevi aleihem Choshech. So why was Choshech? Here the Torah says it was B'chol Eretz Mitzrayim. Choshech was everywhere. The Midrashim tell us the Jewish people didn't experience it. They were able to see. The Egyptians weren't. At a certain point, they couldn't move. But why was it Bechol Eretz Mitzrayim? Shehayu b'Yisrael b'oso haduar reshaim v'lo hayu rotzim matzeis. There were reshaim, evil people that lived in this generation that didn't want to leave, and they died in these 3 days. Mefarshim even goes so far to say that 2 million Jews died in Makas Choshech. So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky is troubled by what was it that made them reshaim? What was it that they caused them not to leave and to die in Makas Choshech? So Rav Yaakov writes the following. He writes, you do see proof that even by the Kriyas Yamsuf, the Yamsuf didn't want to split for the Jewish people, because Hashem says the Yamsuf claimed they're Ovdei Avodah Zarah and they're Ovdei Avodah Zarah. So what is it now that they're doing? So he says something. He says, "B'mishum she'elu hayirotzim la'akeh b'yadehim shalacheir milatzeis." These individuals, which there were a lot of, were going to hold the Jewish people back and cause them not to leave. They were going to block the borders and not allow Klal Yisrael to leave Egypt. The Haim Savru, Shemikaven Shekabala Biyadam Shishtabdu Dala Meosh. They felt that there was a Kabbalah, there was a Masorah tradition, that the Jewish people were going to leave after 400 years, and it wasn't 400 years yet. Therefore, they were not allowed to leave. Righteously, they were going to block the Jewish people from leaving physically. And they didn't believe in Moshe and the other elders, the Zakenim of the generation, who told them, right? Who told them that Hashem said, we can leave now. And the 400 years, you're miscalculating it. They said, now is the time. Aval klal kulo, right? And they felt this, they weren't going to leave. And therefore they did this, right? They were blocking them from getting to Har Sinai, leaving Egypt, and ultimately making it to Eretz Yisrael. That's what was, he says, this in a certain way, right, helps us understand what these people were doing. It wasn't just they were arbitrarily, wrong or reshayim. They were very misguided and extreme in their opinions. And to the extent that they were willing to withhold other Jews from doing something that they felt was incorrect. Yeah. It's why was Erevav allowed to go? So it's not clear who the Erevav was. This is like one of my, we need to look into, like one of these days, we'll have to like look into who, different opinions. Was the Erevav Jewish? Were they not Jewish? Was the Erev Rav like the front runners of the Egyptians who wanted to follow them, who thought that like now the Jewish people are the chosen nation and let's go? Were they other prisoners who were like who also left in the times of Egypt? Or were they Jews that were just misguided also? If you take the third approach that they were misguided too, then they were not as bad as the Jews that didn't make it out. Seemingly, these were even, they had some zechuyos at this time, and they caused, more good than not to allow them to leave. But I do think it requires more homework to look into who the Rabbi was.
Rabbi?
Wait, Rabbi, one second. Yeah, Sam?
Yeah, my question is this. They say, I've heard that there's a midrash based on, in next week's parsha in B'Shalach, it says that they went to Yamsuv v'chamushim,
The Chamushim Alu, yes.
Right, and yes. I understand that means, it's been interpreted to mean that only a fifth left.
Correct.
So that means if what's, I mean, somebody who with a better math head can tell you what, if 3 million was 20%, as a lot of people who died in the darkness.
Yes, 100% a lot of people. Yeah, it's a lot.
I mean,
of
and you just, I don't understand.
Yeah, it might be more. That. It might be more than 2 million, 100%.
If my calculator is right, it was a lot more than that, and I don't. That, it just seems.
Others interpret.
It seems almost incomprehensible.
Correct, Sam. Others interpret not chamushim alu, but that 4/5 left and 1/5 stayed behind. Different. Yeah, Mendy.
Is it the error of Rav or not? Like you said, they are the pictures of everyone. Was it this motion in front of him? Did it by himself? He didn't have
to allow the error to leave?
Yeah.
Could be.
That's my answer.
If anyone's ever seen a good if you've seen a good article on the error, I'd love to see it. I haven't seen anything that like really goes through the different approaches of who the Arab was. I'm sure there's more than one, right? There's, like I said, there's probably at least three out there of who they were. And therefore, I think that will affect the other, that trickle effect of who they were and how they were let out was going to lead us to, you know, different approaches. Rashi always blames the Arab Rav for a lot of things. Chet Egel, they were the ones, they were the riffraff that was, you know, with the man, they were the one that were always complaining. It's not always clear. That's Rashi's approach generally throughout the next few parashios and also in Sefer Bamidbar. Okay. I think we buried them in Egypt during those 3 days. The Chevra Kadisha was very busy. I mean, that's why it was dark and we were able to do it. Okay, let's.
Yes.
Let's go on. So Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Lamed Beis. This pasuk struck me last night. So the Jewish people are leaving Egypt. When you go through the Pesukim, when we get the Choshech, the way that the Parsha goes, the storyline, the narrative, it gets very unclear. Because after Choshech, we get Chodesh Elachem, we get the mitzvah of Korban Pesach, and then it's not clear like when Makas Bechoros happens. We get a tzivoy for it, and then we're leaving. There's like a little bit. It's a little bit confusing. So the Jew, Vayi Bechatzi Alayla, the Torah tells us in the middle of the night, Hashem decimates, destroys, kills all the Bechorei Mitzrayim. Mi Bechor Para Yoshev Al Kiso, from all the Bechor, right? Abachor Shvi, all the different types. So no matter what level or status economically you are in Mitzrayim, every Bechor dies on that night. Vayakam Paro Balayla, who? Your Paro gets up that night. He, right? Paro in pajamas in the middle of the night. Wonderful. That's why we're going to have the pajama party this past Motzei Shabbos in honor of that Maimer Chazal. And now Paro tells them, get out of here. Got to leave. And Paro says the following. I never really noticed this before. V'gam sonechem, v'gam becharchem kuchu. Take your animals. Right before the whole discussion, men, women, children, animals, it was a whole discussion, it was a whole negotiation. Take everything. Go, just go. Kasher dibarkim, like we spoke about. Balechu, good. Now he says the following. Uveirachtem gamosi. He's talking to Moshe and Aaron, and he says, take all your things, get out of here, uveirachtem gamosi, but give me a bracha. Gam, also, and give me a bracha. Is it Moshe and Aaron a Chassidish Rebbe? Like what? What does this mean? Why is Paro asking Moshe and Aaron, right? And this is maybe the first proof we have of Rabbanim, right? Leader giving brachos, and it's to a non-Jew for that fact. What is Paro asking? What's Paro asking for over here? So there is a a discussion in the Rishonim as to what exactly Paro is asking for. Rashi is the simplest interpretation. Rashi says here, Hispalu alai shelo amos. I'm a bechor too, and I'm afraid I'm going to die in this plague. Please daven that I don't die. Okay, that is Rashi. Simple. The Or Chaim here, it's not really a bracha, just make sure the makkah doesn't affect me. The Or Chaim HaKadosh writes, Kilu amar v'gam tevarchu osi. The shir kasav uberivtem gam kin ani v'vachi asir hamakkah harchakas hanezek v'akravas atuelis. The Or Chaim, as well as others, say that Paro was concerned a little bit more. What was he concerned about? He was concerned that his country was going to be so decimated and so destroyed that it would be impossible for them to recover. Think about the news now about recovery and the whole machlokas amongst the politicians about what should be in the Build Back Better bill, right? So there's a concern. We can all agree there's a concern about recovery after almost 2 years of people out of jobs, people not working, industries really shutting down, and what that means for people. So Paro was really concerned about this. So Paro says, I need my country needs a bracha. Please bless Egypt as you leave Egypt. Yes.
It's also on top of that, the higher you are, the harder you fall. It was Paro running to this, it's being too far, right? It's really difficult to control with that. The higher you are, when you fall.
Yeah.
The harder you fall. And that's why.
So these are personal reasons.
So it's a realization.
Yeah. Right, 100%. So that's Rashi and a team of Rishonim that say it was really personal. It was selfish. You have one, you have a chidas, last moment with Moshe and Aaron. Give me bracha, which is an amazing thing. That's like the last moment that he has with them is give me a bracha.
Rabbi?
As if he's holding out. Rabbi? Yeah, is that Sharon?
Yeah, when you think about it, it is the ultimate confirmation of what it is that Hashem wanted, that Paro would accept the Ribbono Shalom as the master of the universe. Correct. And here it is, he's going, yeah, can he give me a bracha?
Yeah, I need some of that, right?
So it's give me sort some of that.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, Yossi.
He was afraid that the people would like it, the life in the
right, so that's the personal, right? Other Rishonim add to that. Like the second the Jewish people leave, like forget about it. You're gonna be hung. We're gonna take your body. We're gonna make a. You should have let them go earlier. You mishandled this whole mess with the Jewish people. Forget about it, right? That's what's going on. The Ksav Kabbalah adds to the Or Chaim. It's something very real. I think we can relate to. He says, there's no greater bracha than what Paro is asking for right now. What's Paro asking for? That the Egyptians should not be worried that more makos are going to come. That Paro knew as a leader that once they left, there was going to be a continued fear of and anxiety that makos would be coming even when they weren't. That there'd be a rainstorm that would last too long, or the wind in Egypt would get very strong, and that would be an additional plague. What would the plague be? Post-traumatic stress disorder. That they would be living a life cowering in fear that the makos are coming back. long after the Jewish people leave. And he says, when Paro and Moshe and Aaron take leave, and Klal Yisrael takes leave of them, Paro is davening, right? He's davening. He's asking Moshe, daven for me and daven for my people, that we can let you guys go and not have this in our memory and not keep this as a traumatic part of who we are, right? And I think that that's something very, is that possible? I don't know if that's possible, you know, but we can appreciate that in a very real level, how much, you know, the impact of trauma and exposures and vaccinate, all of this has impacted us. And if we could only daven, right, that, okay, we'll get through it and we'll go through it and be resilient, that it doesn't have those long-lasting effects. That we don't, yeah, we need to act when we need to act, but that the anxiety and the stress, and that can go away. That we don't need afterwards. And that is something positive to daven for. That we don't need to live in continuous and constant fear. Yes.
If you move this, that is part of my problem. That's let's go get it. You know, it's like, you would see that
he's out
for the count, right? And then he wakes up and he has
what's yeah, and that's part two. That's like, if it ended here, great. Then the Egyptians can just move forward and build back greater together and sign whatever bills they need to in Congress and take care of that, you know, print their money and whatever and give it out. Inflation rate will go up, but okay, fine. They'll move on, but they don't do that. That
so we told people, let's get back what's ours.
Right. So we'll have to talk about that more next week. What, you know, what was on Paro's mind? Why did he, if this is right, the position or approach we're taking, and Paro's like, we're gone, we're out for the count. Let's count our losses. And then he just says, forget about it. That was yesterday. Now let's go, let's get it back. It's like, what was he thinking? What was he thinking? It's a fair question. We have to ask that question. Okay, we discussed today, number one, Laman Tisaper, the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, given to specifically to Moshe Rabbeinu. The second thought we discussed, which one was the second? Oh, Ryakov Kamenetsky on why the Jewish people left Egypt. The third was the bracha, Moshe and Aaron serving as Hasidish Rebbes in Mitzrayim. The fourth idea comes from Rabbi Franz Haggadah. Rabbi Franz Haggadah, he writes the following. Rabbi Franz writes that why do we say in Haggadah? Haggadah writes, Yachol me Rosh Chodesh, that there was a Havamina, a thought that from Rosh Chodesh Nisan, we should begin Pesach. Pesach should begin not on the 15th of Nisan. Pesach should begin on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. And you know, to be honest, if you're doing so much work, you might as well get, it should be like a 22-day holiday. Like, why should it be 7 or 8 days? Like in America, like we add one day. Okay, we justify like all that work that we do. So it makes sense. I don't know, I hear it. But he asks, why would that be? Why would we think that the holiday should begin on Rosh Chodesh? So he says the following. Where am I going to read from? He quotes the Chikrei Lev, who is Rav Leibel Hyman. He writes that the mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh, the mitzvah of the new months, HaChodesh HaZelachem, was given to us specifically on that day. HaChodesh HaZeh, Aleph Nisan, Lachem, Rishon Hu, Lachem, Lachot Sheyashana. The mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh transfers tremendous power to Bnei Yisrael, control over the moon. The moon is a powerful body. The tides have depended upon the cycle of the moon as many other physical phenomena. When Hashem gave the mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh to Klal Yisrael, he empowered them to take control over the moon. More importantly, He handed control over the calendar to Bnei Yisrael. The Medrash states that if Beis Din determines that the day after the 29th of Elul is the first day of Tishrei, then Hashem commands the angels in heaven to prepare a courtroom so the din of Rosh Hashanah can begin. But if Beis Din decides at some point that they cannot be Mekadesh HaChodesh on 29, then Hashem says to his prosecuting angels, we got one more day until the Beis Din begins. The Medrash follows with a shocking dialogue that takes place between the angels and Hashem. Hashem, the angel says, when's Rosh Hashanah? Hashem says, you're asking me. Don't ask me when Rosh Hashanah is. Ask my people. We all know that Yom Kippur is on the 10th of Tishrei. But when is the 10th of Tishrei? It all depends on when Beis Din decides to Mekadesh the month. This means that everyone is required to fast on a certain day, and if they eat, they incur the punishment of Karis. And a human Beis Din determines which day that takes place. Shockingly, if Beis Din erred in the calculation of Rosh Chodesh, we still set the calendar according to their determination, even if in heaven it is known that it should really have been set a day before or a day later. Kiddush HaChodesh wields tremendous power, which was originally in Hashem's purview, and he handed over to Bnei Yisrael before Yetzias Mitzrayim. Why is that? Tremendous, the koach given to the Jewish people. The Chikrei Leif, Rav Hyman, suggests that Hashem wanted to change the mindset of Bnei Yisrael, who had just spent over two centuries as slaves. A slave is absolutely powerless. He has no self-determination whatsoever. He has to follow his master's every whim. The Ibn Ezra writes in Perek Chafal, there is nothing harder for a person than to be under the control of a person just like him. Slavery is demoralizing. It makes a person lose his sense of dignity. Hashem was about to release the Jewish people from slavery. How do you take a nation with a slave mentality and turn them into a nation that will be worthy of calling a chosen nation? Give them power. Show them that they now are in charge. You're raising children, and you want to first show your children that you trust them. You give them more responsibility, right? You let them first maybe cross the street by themselves. You're standing by, and you let them do it without you looking. Eventually, they're going to be driving a car on their own. The more responsibility you give them, right, the more power in a healthy way that they feel. Hashem now said, maybe in a dramatic way, because it was so entrenched in the psyche of the Jewish people that they were slaves, that he needed to give them a mitzvah, the first mitzvah, to show them that they were no longer powerless and that they had the koach to do so much and accomplished so much, they had so much potential. And now it's through the mitzvah of HaChodesh HaZalachem, the mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh. That is a sort of beautiful thought. Rabbi Franz Haggadah is excellent. I saw this 3 years ago. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece here in his Haggadah. It's amazing. Last thought here comes from a sefer called Otsar Plos HaTorah, which means the Otsar, the collection, the compilation of amazing things in the Torah. And that's literally the Sefer talks about wild and different ideas. Here, this is not so wild, this approach on its own, but it's a very fascinating thought. So the Jewish people leave Egypt, and what do they take when they leave Egypt? What are they taking from the Egyptians? Gold, silver, and smalot, clothing. Klei kesev uklei zahav usmalot. We don't talk about the smalot too much. We talk about the gold and silver, golden calf, the Mishkan. All was created from these reparations, restitution, whatever you want to call it. This was it. So now, Rabbi Lam.
Yeah, I don't think they were told in the beginning that they should take smalot. That came along much later. Beginning Rabbi was Lapp only Kesef resolved.
Rabbi Lapp is correct that the smalot was added later on. This haftacha, this promise of getting gold and silver, appears many, many times in the Torah. It appears first by Avraham Avinu, Bris Mila Nesarim, and then Moshe is told this by the burning bush. I think maybe once, but it might be twice. And then again by Makas Choshech. Go check it out, and then you'll take it on your way out. Borrow it on your way out. Now, there's a lot of questions there about deception, etc. I want to focus on one question here. They Chazal say that there was a schus of in the schus of a few things, the Jewish people left Egypt. Shloshinu es shema, they didn't change their names, and shloshinu es levusha, they didn't change their clothing. This is why they're taking the non-Jewish clothing. How can they take the Egyptian clothing? They're leaving, so now they don't have to listen anymore. All of a sudden, their names are going to be non-Jewish names, and they can wear non-Jewish clothing. What's going on here? So, the Chasam Sofer writes. He writes about Hasmalos Chaviven Alayen Ki Mitzrayim Lo Shino Maboshein. In Egypt, they didn't change their clothing, but now the clothing represented something else. What the clothing represents? Freedom. Zeichelanis. It could be that clothing is for, again, we're not going to get to a tznias and, you know, whether it elbows and knees and all, but some clothing is prohibited vis-a-vis where you're living. So once they left Egypt, the clothing changed, as the Egyptian clothing specifically. And now what it represented was Zecher Lenes Shiyatsu Mi Mitzrayim Ulashem Mitzvah Zu Hayu Asmalos Chaviv Alayim. The clothing became beloved to them because it reminded them of the Jewish people, reminded them of leaving Egypt. And the Chasam Sofer continues and says, Moshe Rabbeinu, right? What happened by Moshe? When Moshe saved Tzipporah and her sisters were getting harassed at the well, Ish Mitzri Hitzilani, an Egyptian man saved us. He's wearing Egyptian clothing, so they thought he was an Egyptian man. That's what they thought. So here, the Chasam Sofer shows that what is the clothing? The clothing shows the miracles that happen, and it's a sign of victory over your oppressors, which is something similar, he says, you see later on in Tanakh. Achashverosh, right? Achashverosh, what was he wearing at his party? Big Day Kahuna, right? He was showing that he was victorious over the Jewish people. How do you show victory? By wearing their clothing. When you're wearing their clothing of nobility, you're showing that you are victorious over them. That's like the greatest sign of victory. That's what he suggests here. But then there's another fascinating additional point here, which I never thought of before. Later on in Parshas Ekev, right, we could talk about clothing for a long time. In Parshas Ekev, the Torah tells us, Sim lasecha lo valsa me'alecha, that the miracle was that the clothing never got tarnished. It never got tattered or torn. And the way that most Mefarshim understand this, that this is miraculous. Because of the Anane HaKavod, they kept the clothing fresh and clean and pristine. However, the Ibn Ezra, the Pashtun, you know what he writes here? That's not what it means. What it means? The Jewish people just took a lot of clothing from the Egyptians. So everyone got a suitcase of clothing from the Egyptians, or a trunk, a duffel bag of clothing from the Egyptians. And the clothing never wore out because they always had enough clothing to change into. That's Ibn Ezra over here. The Balaturim elsewhere. The Balaturim elsewhere says no. Each Jew took two pieces of clothing. Two pieces, that's it. One to wear and one to what? Anyone know? What?
Yeah.
To cover the matzahs. The Torah tells us in our parsha, Misharosam tsuros besimlosam. The seor, right, the dough that turned into matzah, was covered with a simla. So the Balaturim writes, one pair of clothing. He follows the Medrash literally, that the Anane Kavod took care of their clothing, and it helped grow with them. And the second one covered the matzahs, and that's it. So fascinating machlokes here between the Ibn Ezra and the Balaturim, exactly how much clothing they took out. And additionally, the Chasam Sofer addresses that important medrash regarding the Simla Secha. So today we discussed five ideas, and I want to take your questions. Five ideas.
Yes.
One, Lamanta Saper. Why is that the mitzvah given Dafka by Arbe? What was so bad about the people who were killed in Makas Choshev? Third, the bracha that the Paro gave to the Egyptians. Why is that? Why did Paro ask for a bracha? From Moshe. Fourth idea is the why do we think that Pesach should have began on Rosh Chodesh Nisan? Beautiful thought from a friend quoting the Chikre Lev. And number five is the role of the clothing when leaving Egypt. Wish everybody a great Shabbos.
Rabbi
Go ahead, Rabbi Lapp.